Coming up on This Week in Google, I, Jason Howell, I'm joined by Ron Richards and Matthew Ingram. We're going to talk about a bunch of leaks ahead of Google's big hardware event that happens next month. Also, we talk about the EU regulatory issues that Google's dealing with and how that might translate into problems here in the U.S. and, you know, a whole lot more. This Week in Google is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 423, recorded Wednesday, September 20th, 2017. I can't hear you over the internet. This episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE. To learn more about fiber optic download speeds on a smartphone, go to snapdragon.com/gigabit. And by Felix Gray. Give your eyes the break they deserve. Felix Gray glasses filter blue light and reduce eye strain without the ugly yellow tint distortion of other computer glasses. Go to felixgrayglasses.com/twig to try a pair today. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, and I'm Jason Howell. Leo Laporte is not here. He is traveling the world. I don't even know what magical wonderland he is at today. He's probably sleeping, actually, at this point, because he's on the other side of the world. But more power to him, and I wish him the best on his travels and having a whole lot of fun. Maybe I'll go to France someday, too. Who knows? But I have so I'm here in place of Leo, and we have also Jeff and Stacy are both out today. But we've got an awesome lineup, starting, of course, with someone who you're probably already familiar with from earlier this week, because it has been the week of Ron. Ron Richards, my co-host on All About Android. How's it going, Ron?
Yes, it's good to be back 3 days in a row in the Twit camp. This is my swan song on the week of Ron. So thanks for having me back.
What are we going to do on this network when Ron goes down to one day a week again?
I don't know, man. I don't know. But, you know, I do love me talking some This Week in Google. For some reason, I seem to always end up getting scheduled when you're here, Jason. Not that that's a problem. I love that. But it's fun to talk about a little more than just Android.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I completely agree. Also joining us, and one of my favorite guests on the show, and I think I've already told you that in the past, Matthew Ingram is here, matthewingram.com/work. I just love your perspectives, and I love the work that you do.
Oh,
and it's great to have you here today, Matthew.
I love you, too.
Oh, shucks. Oh, it's a total Google love fest around here.
It's a lovin'.
Which is kind of fitting because, you know, the show is obviously, you know, it's dedicated to Google. It's in the title, This Week in Google, which kind of ties right into the very top. Apparently 5 days ago, it was a Googleversary. Google.com domain was registered 20 years ago today, if today were September 15th.
So this actually had me thinking, do you remember the first time you became aware of Google and or used it?
Oh, boy, that's a good question.
Right? And so because like right around this time, 1998, or 97, right? Mm-hmm. I was a diehard Alta Vista guy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sounds about right for that time. It was the Alta Vista, I'm not sure.
What about Dogpile? Do you remember that?
I remember Dogpile.
You could search a bunch of different engines.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then there was Hotbot. Remember Wired had their own.
Yeah, at that time we came out, you know, like we're coming off of Yahoo in the mid 90s and it was all curated and it wasn't really searching, it was just more curated, right?
Yep.
And then you're right, Hotbot from Wired and then Alta Vista and then Lycos.
Lycos,
right?
Yeah,
Lycos. Yeah. And actually, I remember thinking when Google came out, I thought, A, that's a dumb name. And B, I thought, you know, Alta Vista is pretty good. Like, how much better could the search engine possibly be? Like, Alta Vista finds stuff, right, that I need. It's not that, like, it's not rocket science. How much better could this search engine be? And, well, as it turns out, a lot better.
I do remember that as well. Alta Vista was at the top of my list. It was my go-to. I don't know if it was right about this time 20 years ago today, but that seems about right. God, 20 years ago, that feels like a long time ago.
Alta Vista was like the game changer for me because I'm like, wow, this is actually giving powerful results. And I remember playing with Inktomi. Do you remember Inktomi?
Yes.
Yeah, right? Yeah. InfoSeek. Yeah.
InfoSeek.
It was a wasteland of search engines out there in the late 90s.
Well, we just didn't know. We didn't have the body of knowledge around what search could be. And now it feels so dominated. I mean, you know, we've got some stories potentially in the lineup for today that are talking about how tech, as you know, as an industry, and especially the big four, the major tech companies are kind of at a point of inflection right now where suddenly all eyes are turning onto them and saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe you control too much. 20 years ago today, search year was a lot more innocent. That's just the all well, you can say about that.
I remember writing at the time, I was writing financial stories for a newspaper in Toronto. I was writing about the stock market. I wrote about Google's IPO. In particular, because it was an unusual kind of IPO. It was a Dutch auction, if you want to know the details. Anyway, at the time, it was unusual. Their shareholders' letter, like founders' letter, was unusual. The fact that they were going to keep so much control is unusual. And I remember writing a column. The consensus was that this stock was not going to be that great because there were lots of other search engines.
Wow.
Google didn't really have that much to bring to the table as far as anyone could tell. It certainly didn't have a business model at the time. And so everybody was like, it sounds great and it's got a weird name, and but should you buy it? Probably not. So
interesting.
Dumb move there historically.
Yeah, you never really know that stuff back at the time. But it also had a very simplistic approach, and that's something that they've carried forward for a long time. That definitely helped it back then, because things were, you know, the web was a pretty noisy place. It still really is, but when it came to search, that was one of the few places that you could go and feel like you weren't bombarded by a million other things at the same time.
Well, it was also, I was going to say, I also remember when Google first came out, and when I first discovered it, it had to have been, it wasn't as early as 97. I would be lying if I was like, I was there early on, but realistically probably like late 98, 99 is when I caught wind of it. But the two things that attracted me to it was just the plain white, you know, minimal design, you know, and you just got results. And, you know, this is before they rolled out the ad model and things like that. And then also the gimmick of the I'm feeling lucky button. I think that was the thing that someone's like, oh, have you seen this? You just hit this button, it goes anywhere on the web. And it's like, you know, and that was, you know, it's having a kind of a fun approach to search, that the other ones, like AltaVista, while it was great, was very, it was from digital, it was IT driven, you know, like it was very, you know, bare bones and very kind of boring. So Google brought a little fun to the table, I thought, at least at that time.
Well, and at the time, the big criticism was sort of no business model, but then they quickly basically borrowed a business model from Overture and Bill Gross. But it was, that was probably the single best kind of accidentally like backing into a business model that we've ever seen, certainly in my lifetime.
Yeah.
The amount of value that has generated is mind-boggling.
Yeah. It's crazy. Well, because really right around the IPO, I mean, I remember the flurry. I mean, we didn't see Maps or Gmail,
right,
or all the things that we associate with Google till the mid-2000s, like 2003, exactly. Right? Like around there. Like I remember the flurry to get a Gmail account. Like you need to get a beta invite and all this sort of stuff. You know, but at the time in the 90s, it was just search, and it was just that, you know, ads against search, and for some reason it stuck out. And I remember the day I switched, you know, to Google as my primary search engine, and when I switched from IE to Firefox as my primary browser. Those were like two big days in like 99, 2000. I remember happening.
Now, what about switching from Firefox to Chrome, though, Ron?
Yeah. That was probably 06, 07 maybe, okay. Like around, yeah, a little later.
Probably,
but
about
yeah,
the same time for me too.
I mentioned to Leo the other day when I was on that one of the big moments for me Google-wise was when they launched Google Earth. I'd seen Keyhole before, which they acquired, but Google Earth was a mind-boggling. It was one of those moments when, like, even as a jaded sort of tech reporter, I felt like, man, we are living in the future. Like, this is... You can zoom in. It's like science fiction.
I completely agree. It made the world feel accessible, which is exactly what it was doing, right? It allowed you to really just pick a location on the globe and say, I want to see what's happening there or what happened there at a certain point in time. And before that, it was just never that easy and never.
Exactly.
And it was a really cool tool.
Still
it continues
amazing.
To be cool, yeah.
And Street View, too. I mean, yeah. Street View, our newsroom,
amazing, yeah.
The newspaper newsroom shut down. Like, productivity dropped probably to zero because everybody had to go check out their street and their house.
Right.
And I had a woman I worked with who let out this scream, and I asked her what was wrong, and she said, look at my house. And if you went by her house, she had been getting her groceries out of the car when the Google car went by. So it was basically just her butt. She had bent over into the car.
Awesome.
And she's like, oh, my God. And I said, don't worry. Like, a year from now, they'll get some new shots. And
no, the internet is forever, but not Street View. Yeah, Street View, they refresh those things. So you're okay.
Yeah. Before we move on, I just ran into a very funny Google-esque thing. Because I wanted to, you know, we're having this little nostalgia trip, and I wanted to pull up, like, you know, when did stuff, certain Google products come out and things like that. So I just went to Google and wrote Google history, and the search results I got were, welcome to my activity to find your search history. And then it's all about viewing and controlling your account.
Right.
And I can't actually find the history of Google because I'm getting all return results about my history with Google. It shows you how pervasive it's become in our lives. Yeah. So.
That's actually, in terms of the thing that makes the biggest difference to me, sort of on a day-to-day basis with Google, it's not, Google Maps is great and everything, but Google Photos changed my life in a lot of ways. I mean, just having everything there, having it searchable all the time, being able to just type in my daughter's name and photos come up. It's simple, but it did change things for me significantly.
And also looking at it in the context of 20 years ago, 1997 was also the year that Ask Jeeves came out, which is now Ask.com, which at the time I had trained myself in using AltaVista to do keyword-based search. Like, realistically, in this Google search for Google's history, I should have searched Google company history, and that would get me better results. But I remember at the time Ask was like, you just ask it a question and it's natural language and that'll never work. But I realized a couple of years ago, and Jason, I think we talked about this on another show a while back, more often than not, I'm not doing keyword searches on Google these days. I'm doing what is the temperature in Chicago right now? And I'm asking Google natural language questions and it's answering me.
Well, and Google has formatted its business around that, right? With Assistant, with Google Voice Search and everything like that. They continues to strive towards a more conversational approach. But yeah, I remember that back then, and I remember using ask.com and going, wow, this is really cool. I don't have to like think of a syntax or whatever. I just asked it a question. It didn't always work the way you expected it to, but you can see where that led to. I mean, that's really where we're at right now with Google's muscle behind it. That's what we have, and it's super effective. It's awesome.
And I've noticed that the natural language questions work way better. So if I just search keywords like record phone call, Skype, Chromebook, or whatever, which I was doing recently, I don't get as good results as if I type in how do I record a Skype call on my Chromebook.
Mm-hmm. Right. And interesting. Well, Google, we love you. That's why we're here, and that's why we just spent 10 minutes talking about your 20-year anniversary.
Hey, man, nostalgia trip, sign me up for any time, you know? Like, I'm surprised they haven't done some sort of, like, try Google in a year, you know, and it will change Google
cool,
to look like how it did in 2000 or something. Yeah, that'd be neat.
That would be really cool. They should totally do that.
Oh, there you go, Google. Free marketing ideas.
There you go.
Sundar's listening.
For their 25th anniversary, just for the day, even.
Sure, Sundar's listening.
Well, yes.
Of course.
We know Sundar, he is.
Sundar is a big fan of Jason and I, so we're positive that he tunes in to any time we're talking about Google.
Sundar's not quite a friend of the show in a technical sense yet. We have yet to interview Sundar on the show, but once we do, he will, and I'm sure it'll happen, he will become friend of the show. Maybe it'll happen on This Week in Google.
I'm willing to give him future friend of the show designation.
Okay.
He's going to be a friend of the show.
he's a little creeped out right now. All right. So, hey, why don't we talk about, I think this was the big news yesterday, and it's kind of a, you know, like, here we are to spoil the party. But Droid Life went on a tear, if you didn't know, yesterday. If you were waiting for Google's upcoming announcement of their new Pixel lineup of devices, we knew because Google had posted a video teasing something happening on October 4th. It was a short video, kind of a little cryptic, you know, do you want better battery life? Or, you know, do you want your phone to be smarter. It asked all these questions. It didn't really announce an actual event. Well, since then, Google has sent out press invites for an official event that happens on October 4th in San Francisco, 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. And that's exactly a year from this time last year when Google showed off its first generation Pixel devices. So we know what's in store, particularly because Droid Life spoiled the party and revealed literally, well, I mean, maybe they didn't reveal everything, but they revealed everything that anybody was waiting for. And so we can go through these piece by piece, but I think, you know, obviously the new Pixel devices is something that everybody's looking forward to. They're called the Google Pixel 2 and the Google Pixel 2 XL. Whole variety of colors. You know, in fact, this one, the XL, has like a two-tone color with the glass on top and then, you know, the white bottom part of the phone. And so in many ways looks very similar to last year's models, but with some changes. But the cost, I think the cost is pretty in line as well too, right? Like the smaller Pixel 2, which has HTC's involvement, comes in around $649 for 64 gig, $749 for the 128 gig. And this is what you're seeing right now, the Pixel 2 with HTC. And then the larger one, the XL, comes in around $849 for 64 gigs or $949 for 128 gigs. So we are in premium smartphone territory. Mm. Matthew, what is your phone? What's your daily driver? Is it an iPhone or do you have the Pixel phones or what do you have?
I actually just upgraded. I've got a Samsung Galaxy S7.
Oh, okay.
Before that, I had an LG. I had a Nexus 6. I like the Nexus 6, actually. And I do, even though I have a Galaxy now, they were having a deal, my carrier. So I did like having a Google phone. I did like having like a lack of crapware from Samsung or whoever. I liked having just sort of Google experience, and I liked getting updates, you know, as soon as they were pushed out instead of waiting for Samsung or whoever to push them out. So I've definitely thought about the Pixel. It's a little out of my price range. Like I'm trying to keep costs down. I can't, like, I'm not Leo. I can't buy every phone, you know, that comes out for $1,200 or it just seems
not
like,
many people can. Yeah.
And I was not, I was like the X, the iPhone 10 or X or whatever. And the cost of these phones is just astronomical. I've got kids in university. I can't spend, you know, $2,000 on a phone.
Yeah, $1,000 every year because we are addicted to upgrading our phones every year for some reason. What do you think, Ron? I know that you are kind of at a point right now. You just got the Pixel because your Nexbit Robin crapped out not too long ago. So you got that secondhand, but are you thinking you might, I mean, sometimes Google has like a trade in value sort of thing. Maybe you trade up.
Yeah, I'm going to keep an open mind. I will think, you know, we talked a little bit about this last night on All About Android, and I was thinking about it this morning, and if these leaks are true, I'm a little disappointed, similar to how I was disappointed last year that these are all high end flagship price level phones and there's not a $399 version. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love Google to take the pure Android experience and make it more affordable for people. And last time with the Pixels, they had a great financing option and it was exclusive with Verizon, which always has subsidized phones and that sort of thing. But, you know, I get that they want to show this is the best that Android can do. But a part of me thinks it'd be great if they put out a OnePlus competitor or like that mid-range phone as an option. You know, because honestly, that's been, you know, like the Pixel, I did get a secondhand Pixel, and that's been the closest to a flagship phone I've ever had, Jason. You know this. I've always had the, kind of the middle of the road, you know, the kind of, you know, what Google put out. The Nexus 5 was $399. So while I think these phones are nice and new, hot and sexy kind of new models, I wish there was a little more affordable option.
Yeah, I do too. And I think they could do it. I mean, there's nothing stopping them. I guess they just want to be, you know, they want to sexify Android phones a little bit, which is fine.
Yeah, they want to boost the brand image. It really seems like because they have to. I mean, I think we even said this last year, they have to justify the cost. Why does your phone almost cost $1,000? That's an insane price, you know, price category for that to fall into. And is that going to limit people buying the phone? I mean, do we feel like the Pixel experiment one year in paid off for Google? I think Google, I don't know if their intention right out of the gate was to be a Samsung, but I've seen some out in the wild, not in an overwhelming amount, nothing close to what you see with Samsung, but Google's done all right with that, right? From a marketing standpoint.
I think they have. I don't know sort of revenue wise, whether it's making a big difference for them. I've certainly seen lots of people talking about it. I can't say that I've seen that many. I mean, I'm in Canada, so maybe that has something to do with it, but, I do kind of wish they, you know, to Ron's point, the Android phones have had kind of a reputation that they're down market, you know, they're cheap phones for sort of nerds. And I could see that they want to try to move up the kind of scale a little bit. But I don't see why they couldn't do both at the same time.
Yeah, agreed. I think that a part of it is that I think the Pixels have been a success for Google because clearly they're doing it again. I think they're not scrapping the program or anything that. And if the rumors, Jason, we were talking about this over email earlier, if the rumors are true that Google might be, you know, hovering around HTC and purchasing their phone business, it appears as if it's so good that they are getting in bed with a manufacturer. And clearly it's working on some level, but I don't know what the goal is internally inside Google. Is the goal to just have a presence and be on the shelf at the carrier stores? Or is it to set the expectation for the OEMs to follow? Or is it to compete with Samsung? You know, like there's so many different ways to approach it. And I, you know, going back to, you know, future friend of the show, Sundar, I don't know what their goal with the strategy is with these phones.
Yeah, that's why we need to have Sundar on and say, what is the goal of the strategy with these phones, Sundar?
Yeah.
And he would answer, and then we'd say, thank you for
another we would get the stock marketing answer to be like, do we want to make a phone that shows what Android can do and the pure Google experience and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I could hear him saying it. He said it at last year's event. We've seen that. But from a sales standpoint, like, I don't know if Google wants to compete with Samsung. You know, the sheer volume of phone. Like, is Samsung being in the Android phone business good for Google? Yeah, it is.
Absolutely.
Right? Because it's increasing Android's market share, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, it definitely does not seem like the goal for Google is to push all of its partners out the door and be like, nope, we've got the only phone that anybody ever wants. It seems just like a part of me almost feels like Google's doing it because they feel like they have to do it. Like, we have to have hardware that has our name on it. We're Google, and we make the phone system, and, you know, we make the system that it runs on. And of course, everyone expects for us to have it. We're like Apple. We have our hardware, right? But they also have others doing it. But you mentioned the HTC deal. So why don't we just talk about that right now? Google apparently might be in a position to announce an acquisition of HTC. And we've been hearing rumors about HTC. I mean, well, we know HTC as a company has been hurting, in a world of hurt, just as, you know, to say the least. Their shares have fallen 94% since their heyday in 2011. Which I've loved HTC's hardware early on, especially in the early days of Android. They were doing some really awesome things. They were doing design and build quality and all this stuff before a lot of competitors were. They were really focused on that, and that really set them apart. But they've really kind of fallen to the wayside over the last however many years. So lots of rumors about HTC and its business and what's going to happen. I feel like we've been hearing about this for 2, 3, 4 years now. And then very recently about the possibility of Google snapping it up, when we can compare this to another time in the history of Google when it snapped up a hardware manufacturer of Motorola and did that, and then a couple of years later sold it off. So we don't know this for sure, though. This is news that's supposedly going to come out soon because HTC halted its stock trading in Taiwan today, I believe, ahead of what they say is an announcement later this week. Could this be the announcement? Does this make sense to you, Matthew, that this would happen, that Google should buy a company like HTC?
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I mean, to be honest, I thought Motorola made sense, but obviously it turned out not to. Mm-hmm. And there were issues with Motorola that maybe aren't the case with HTC. I think in a lot of ways, it does make sense for Google to kind of be vertically integrated that way as much as possible. It gives them a lot more control over costs, gives them a lot more control over sort of margins and stuff like that. So I could see it at the right price. It sounds like HTC is probably going to be pretty cheap. I mean, $300 million or something like that. What is that? Like, to Google, that's right. Like, you know, they could find that in the behind the cushions of the couch in Sundar's office, probably.
Sundar sneezes that into a tissue when he has allergies. That's what that is.
that mental image just.
Sorry, I don't know where that came from. He sneezes money. That is kind of weird.
If it was coins, that would hurt.
It would. Although, if I sneezed and money came out of my nose, I'd be sneezing all the damn time. Just saying.
If it was nickels, you'd be like, oh my God, my nose hurts so much.
It's going to take me a long time for retirement.
I'm so close to $150. But if they are going down this route with HTC, it's hardware go round two, like we said, and I'd be wondering what they've learned from the Motorola experience that led them to sell that business to Lenovo, and you know, do they think they're in a better position now? You know, Rick Osterloh is now with Google. You know, he was a high up guy at Motorola in terms of the product side of things. You know, it seems as if the pieces on the chessboard are in a better position for Google to take on hardware development than when they had Motorola a few years ago.
Yeah, and it also sounds like HTC might not be selling off the HTC Vive division to Google, although I could totally see that working too. Like, why not have that? You know, Facebook has Oculus. Google has its own kind of VR division, and it's the smartphone level of VR. Why not have a premium level VR with the Vive? But that wouldn't happen. Also, Evan Blass, has a source that makes him think that the brand, the HTC brand, might not even be on the table. So it would be kind of the hardware mechanism of HTC that comes over to Google, and not necessarily the HTC brand that stays behind.
And that's actually, I don't think that's bad either, because what, you know, when we talked about.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, when we talked about Google and hardware, we've said, okay, listen, they partnered with folks to design and then to produce these things. The reason why they went to Asus for the tablets or HTC for phones or LG for phones is because they lacked the supply chain and the manufacturing, and that's what this gives them. So they don't need the HTC brand. They just need the phone. And honestly, I like HTC phones. Mm-hmm. I mean, squeezable buttons aside, I think HTC has done some pretty good stuff for Android over the years.
A little squeezable,
especially especially if HTC's, you know, what contributes all the hardware for the Pixel. If they really want the Pixel to be, you know, a symbol of what Google can do with hardware and software, then it makes sense for them to own that whole thing beginning to end.
Agreed. Apparently we're not going to have to wait very long to hear what this announcement is. I don't know what else it could be. Maybe it's something entirely unrelated, but we will certainly find out. And yeah, I mean, like I said, they've halted their shares. They have a major announcement, so it sounds pretty critical. Sounds like a pretty big deal. This would fall into line with that. There are other things that have been leaked, and we will talk about those. But before we do that, let's take a quick break and thank the sponsor. And then we'll get back to, I'm really looking forward to this Pixel book. And I know if Jeff Jarvis was on, he'd have a lot to say about it. You'll hear from him another time. We're going to talk about that after the break, though. So let's thank the sponsor, which is Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE. We've all experienced the effects of cellular network congestion. It's no fun. It slows you down in your tracks in crowded environments, airports, shopping malls, all types of busy areas. Your favorite apps can become barely usable. They're just not working the way you know they should be. And that's why Snapdragon Gigabit LTE was designed to deliver the fastest mobile connectivity and help speed things up in crowded places. With additional lanes for your data to flow on and the ability to squeeze more speed from each LTE connection, Snapdragon Gigabit LTE is like driving on a much wider, much faster data highway. Everything moves smoother. And average LTE download speeds are up to 7 times faster than typical home Wi-Fi. You're going to notice the speed difference. It can turbocharge all of your connected apps, makes things run seamlessly, stream 360-degree videos in YouTube VR in 4K resolution with minimal buffering or stuttering. That's kind of the dream right there. You can access all of your files in the cloud nearly as fast as you would if they were stored on your phone, which is the supreme kind of goal, I think, of cloud file storage is you want it to feel like it's a locally connected drive, and you get that with Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE. You can download hours of movies or music in a matter of seconds, load Android Instant apps almost instantly, obviously. It's in the name there. But it makes it feel like it's an app that you already had installed because it happens so fast. Make the most of your unlimited data plan to learn more about faster network connections in crowded places. All you have to do is visit snapdragon.com/gigabit. That's snapdragon.com/gigabit. And we thank Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE for their support of This Week in Google. Some of the other things that were leaked out by Droid Life, and we can kind of pick these apart here. We don't have to go too deep on the Daydream VR headsets, because I think they're just kind of like a little spruce up.
Yeah, it's a little refinement of the design, as well as a more expensive price tag.
Yeah, apparently $20 more. So it was $80 prior, and supposedly when this is announced in a couple of weeks, it's going to be right around $100. So they will have to yet again kind of justify the cost, or maybe they don't have to. Maybe they just put it
comes
out
in coral.
Oh.
Comes,
yeah.
So
coral is right. The new Google hotness, by the way. That coral color is everybody wants it.
Everybody, yeah, they just like saying coral.
No, I really think that this price change is a cost adjustment. I think the original Daydream VR, they priced it too low, or based on the sales, and I think this is a math thing. I think that's why they're raising the price.
Yep.
No internal tracking embedded inside of the headset hardware for $20 more.
In a sweatpants material visor. I don't think so.
Yeah, maybe it has an embedded headband for sopping up the forehead sweat. Sorry, this episode's getting gross. I apologize. Google Home Mini is another thing that we're going to find out about. We had been hearing rumors about this, and, well, we still are, but we have pictures to go with those rumors. Here, it's like a squished Google Home. And it has four LEDs on top. Almost looks like a hockey puck sort of thing. Comes in a few colors, including, like you just said, coral, because coral's the new hotness. $49 for these once they are announced and then released. I feel like we're reporting on an announcement. Nothing's been announced, but we have everything.
It's all
that
rumors.
We need.
It's all rumors.
It's all rumors. But
you know, $49. I was just thinking, if you're, let's say, you haven't kind of bought into Google Home, or you haven't, you know, bought into Google having services like that. $49 is like, you know, why not?
Nothing to sneeze at. Yeah.
Right, and then if you like it, buy a couple more. Like, if it's $50,
At that $49 price point, I'm take my money, sign me up. I'm gonna get one for the bedroom. Done deal.
Yeah, why not?
You know, I think that's exactly the purpose, right? Like, I have a Google Home in my kitchen, the full size Google Home, because that's all we have right now. Yet in the Google Home family of devices, have one in the kitchen, one in the living room. I can't really think of another room that I have to have the full size thing in that I would justify, you know, spending $130 for. But yeah, $50 to just drop it in there, low footprint, so it's not, you know, taking up a huge corner of the room. I'd be down for that.
It could replace the alarm clock. Whether you get your morning briefing, you know, like it having a spot in the, I've already seen, my sister is a Amazon Echo family, and they put the Echo in the kitchen and then Echo Dots in all the bedrooms. Mm-hmm. So the kids have their alarm clock. They listen to music. They use it as the intercom system. Like, having these devices in the individual rooms in a house is a great application of this technology. So I'm glad that this is the next step. And we wanted this when we went at I/O. Remember, we were hoping for a smaller, lower price home device. And I'm glad that we're getting it, or might be getting it if these leaks are to be believed. Yeah.
And that way Google can record you in every room and then use your voice to enhance its algorithms.
It's comprehensive. Keep a running catalog of everything you've ever asked it or said on your Google account summary, which you can get to very easily and listen to those recordings, which, by the way, I think we mentioned on the show before, is hilarious to do. How many times they've fired off accidentally. You hear very random moments of your life played back for you.
Just go back and search Google history in Google and you'll find it. In
exactly.
The first
that should be your end of show tip, Ron.
Yeah, there it is.
That's how you get to it easily. And because it's smaller, you have to imagine that means that the speaker system on it is far less robust than what you get on the larger version. So if you're thinking about every room can have a nice speaker for all of my music, I'm sure it'll be able to be another point in your kind of matrix of Google Homes to interconnect for playing music and stuff. It just probably won't sound nearly as good in those places. So if that's a priority to you, I'm guessing you'll want to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I think I imagine it would be as good as like a Bluetooth speaker, a small one. Yeah. I don't think it's going to compete with Sonos or something like that.
Yeah. But I do love that feature about having multiple Google Homes playing the same thing in multiple rooms simultaneously, you know, all synced up. It's, you know, it's great for dance parties, which we have all the time. I have two girls, so of course we do. And then finally, I'm really excited about this, even though it's incredibly expensive, but I've been waiting for it, and I've been waiting for years. I know Jeff Jarvis has as well. I'm curious to know what you guys think. The Google Pixel Book, which is a Chromebook. You know, their last Chromebook Pixel came out in 2015. I'm still using the one from 2014, and I've had a hard time moving away from it. Got it right here. Hard time moving away from it for any of the other Chromebook options, just because I love the build quality. I feel like it's been powerful enough to do everything I need for the past 4 years or so. And so I've been waiting for an update. Here you go, 128 gigs for $1,199, supposedly, all the way up to 512 gigs for $1,749. So this is a Chromebook competing with regular, like, full-powered laptop on price. Well, I don't know if that's competing on price. Priced similarly. I don't know if they're competing because I don't know how capable it is compared to those. But it does include the ability to use a pen. You get it for another $99, the Pixel Book pen that'll have pressure sensitivity, tilt support, no lag. So I'm sure we'll hear something about how Chrome OS is better, has some sort of stylus support to go along with that. And the whole thing folds into a tablet. So you can run your Android apps in tablet mode and all that kind of stuff. I know I'm getting one. I probably won't get the premium, 512 gigs one, but I'll get the 128 gig one. Sure. That's all I need. What do you guys think?
It's very expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that. I mean, I could buy a MacBook Air, roughly the same price.
Yeah.
To be honest, I like the Chromebooks and I've been using one for the past like 3-4 months and it's an old one, so it's a little underpowered, but I have no problems with it. And I like the idea that these have better build quality. They're not, they don't feel as sort of low end or cheap. But do I need something that turns into a tablet? No. Do I need a stylus? Probably not. Yeah. So then those things are going to be lost on me. Are that many people really going to use this thing and turn it into a sort of clamshell tablet? Maybe.
I think that, and I said this last night on All About Android, but not for those who didn't watch that, I think that this is a lot of Google competing with Microsoft and the Surface Books. What Surface has been doing with styluses and creativity and in the classroom and making, like, Microsoft is making a run at Apple to woo back artists with the Surface Studio, those big desktops and things like that. And and they've been, they've really been pushing those Surface convertible laptops, tablet combinations. And I think Google sees Microsoft making headway in that space and saying, okay, well, this is us competing with that because ultimately Google wants to get in the classroom as well too. But at this price point, it's not realistic for, creative types who are notoriously, starving artists, as well as education, where there's never enough money for education. So
it's not just that. I mean, if you're a creative type and you want to do things with a stylus, you're probably going to want to install software. You're probably going to want all sorts of graphics, software. And there are cloud versions of those, most of them, but they're, they're not as full-featured as the ones you can install.
Yeah. The original Chromebook Pixel launched back in – the one I have right here launched back in 2013.
You love that thing.
And it – I love it, but with an asterisk, which I'll talk about in a second here.
I was at the launch, actually.
Okay. So there you go. And I mean,
I was working for GigaOM at the time, so I was in San Francisco.
And I'm guessing because the price point is the same. Well, it's not the same, but it's very close. Then the price point entry level was $12.99, or you could get it for $14.49 with an LTE connection. Nothing about an LTE connection on the new version, at least in the leaks, anyway. So I guess we'll find out. My asterisk, Ron, is that I didn't buy this. We got it as a Google I.O. right. handout for one of the years of Google I.O. So then I have to ask myself back then, would I have ever dropped down the money for it? And the answer would have been no. At this point, I would put down the money for it because I've grown to really love this machine and I've used it so much over the years. And I realize that it's under power. Not as capable as a full, blown like MacBook Pro or whatever. But that's not why I use it. I use it because it's super light. It does exactly what I need to do on the shows here, and it's great for travel. And having one that I feel, the same kind of like I like good design, and everything about the build quality of this laptop makes me happy, I guess. So I guess to that degree, I don't mind spending a little bit more than $1,000 on a new one that's going to last me 4 or 5 years, which is what this has done.
Have you ever found anything that you wanted to do that you couldn't do on the Chromebook?
No, I mean, there are things that it obviously does not do, but I'm fine with that because I have other solutions for that, right? Like I have a desktop computer at home. And if I really need to do some of those like video editing or audio editing, I wouldn't want to do it on a laptop anyways. I hate doing that stuff on a laptop. I like doing it on a desktop. So maybe that's the trade-off, right? I have another computer at home that can do those things, or at work here. You know, it's a desktop setup in my office. So, but this just gets relegated specifically to my browsing, which is like 99% of what I ever do anyways. And it's a nice one. Instead of having like a built out of plastic thing where the trackpad feels all hollow when I tap it and everything like that, I feel like it's a MacBook Pro, but with Chrome OS. And for some reason that works for me. And that didn't happen initially. When I first got it, I was scratching my head going, why would I ever buy this? But over the years, it's really won me over.
And since I've been using this Chromebook, I have, found it useful for almost everything. Since it is a little underpowered, it has problems streaming, high quality video, for example, to the TV. But that I can understand. It's an old Chromebook. It was my daughter's before we got her an Air. And I've been thinking, next computer I get, why don't I just get the Pixel, for example? But there's like one or two things that I do that it can't do. And so then I wonder if it's not going to be, if I can't use it as my main computer, like I can't figure out how to record Skype calls, for example. There's no plug-in that works. So Skype works fine. But for my job, I need to record those calls. I couldn't figure out how to do it. There appears to be no easy way to do it except using a free conference call service, which is all kinds of other hassle. So then if that's one kind of thing that I do a lot, if I get a Chromebook, I'm not going to be able to do that. So then it can't be my kind of main computer.
Yeah.
But this is the discussion that we always end up having, which is that, Matthew, like I think, we're power users, right? Like personally for me, I need to be able to, do graphic editing and audio recording and editing, much like yourself, and every now and then a little video and all this sort of stuff. And these are very processor intensive tools, and we've been raised on application tools and things like that. But the average user might not need to record a Skype call. They just need to use Skype to talk to somebody, I wonder, the pool of potential customers for a device like this at this price point are like, business travelers who are dialed into the Google network, Google ecosystem, much like, people are dialed into the Apple iCloud ecosystem or Microsoft Office or whatnot. This device might not be for us. We might still need a MacBook Pro or MacBook Air or whatnot.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, but
it does make sense. Yeah. It does make sense for schools. It does make sense, I think, for students. It probably makes sense for, road warriors or whatever, if all you need is if everything you can do, you can access on the web. I was thinking of one kind of interesting target market. foreign travelers coming into the U.S., you could have a bare Chromebook, nothing on it, just basically a browser. You bring it into the U.S., they can't find anything on it. They can't look at anything on it. So you can do your work kind of assuming you can do everything on the internet, leave your regular computer at home.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's so easy to set up a Chromebook. You just log into your account and everything just goes brrrp, and in like 30 seconds, everything is back there as if it was your laptop forever. That's a really good point. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the question that you posed, Ron, and that kind of that you're talking about there, Matthew, too, is I don't know if that's like Google's end game necessarily. Like, well, we'll target, you know, people who are traveling internationally and certain business travelers. Like, it is still a question that I have, even though, like, I'm excited to get the Pixel Book if and when it comes out. And even though I also say that, knowing that it's very expensive and that maybe it isn't worth it, I don't know, but I'm still going to get it. I still have a hard time understanding who their target actually is on this. Because, I mean, regularly, at least in the industries that we run in, there are reasons that this does not make sense. So it's easy to kind of fall into the talking point of this just doesn't work for anybody. It works for somebody. Who is that somebody?
In a way, they're kind of trapped in a catch-22. Yeah. The only people I hear talking about Pixels are nerds.
Right.
And yet nerds are often power users who want more computer, who want to install things or screw around with the OS or whatever. And so they're not going to probably get them. Yeah. So they get them as a second or third computer. So that's not a big market.
Right.
And the interesting thing, when it first launched, I will say, you know, that was a long time ago in internet terms, 2014. But at the time, what it said to me was, and maybe this was what they meant by launching it, was it was a symbol of how much the future was going to be all about the web and all about, so as long as you had a connection, you would be able to do just about everything. Mm-hmm. And they, at the time, there were lots of things you couldn't do. Now, there's a few. So we have sort of kind of seen what they were talking about at the time, which is that more and more stuff has gone to the cloud, more and more stuff has gone to the web, so you don't have to have as much kind of on your machine, and you can use a thing that gives you a connection and nothing else.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We will see. I was also, as you were talking, kind of taking a look over The Verge's 2013 review, and I mean, it just ties right into what you're saying. My, how much things have changed since even 2013. But then again, how much things have stayed the same, because it's, you know, when I look at like the cons on this original device, it was, you know, that Chrome OS is severely limited, that price is a deal breaker. Price will probably be a deal breaker here as well. And actually, what we were just talking about as far as like trying to find who this would be marketed to, I just kind of assumed that's why Google apparently had stopped doing the Chromebook Pixel, right? They did 2013, they did 2015, and then there was nothing. And I was like, okay, well, maybe that was an experiment that just didn't pan out. The only people that I ever really saw using it were Leo, myself, and then if I went to Google I/O, I saw lots of people that worked for Google using them there.
Yeah.
But you don't really see them anywhere else. So maybe that just didn't work, but apparently it did because it's coming back.
And it seems like the Pixel Book, changing the name, you know, they want to centralize everything around the term Pixel. Forget about the term Chrome. It's probably confusing. Plus, it's not just a Chromebook. You've got Android apps as well. So Pixel Book makes sense.
Yes. And then I think we can get out of the rumor territory. Ron, you were talking about kind of a lower cost to entry device in the Pixel line. This isn't quite that, but we do have the first Android One device to launch in the U.S. That hasn't happened yet. Android One, of course, is Google's kind of budget phone category. I don't know if that's the right kind of way to describe it. It's really been used in a lot of emerging markets to give a lower end device with a lower price point that still has, you know, very minimal UI alterations, has an update schedule that comes direct from Google, and, you know, other benefits like that. Now Motorola with the Moto X4 is launching its Android One device in the U.S., available for Project Fi users. And so that means if you are on Project Fi, before you had, you know, only kind of like premium device options to pick from. Now it's opening up. So you pay $399, which isn't bottom of the barrel pricing, let's say. And certainly it seems kind of expensive for anything we've seen in the Android One category. But less expensive than some of the other options. So maybe this is the middle of the road option that you were talking about, Ron.
I feel like I need to ask Google for $1 million next, and I'll get an email saying, "We've given you $1 million. they're giving me what I'm asking for." But I think that the fact that, you know, that $399 is a great price point, $165 back with select trade-ins.
Yeah,
that makes it even more interesting. And offering $50 in Project Fi credit, that's pretty cool too to help you save money. And the colors are sterling blue and super black. Which is pretty cool.
No coral.
No blue. No kind of blue. But hey, I've been operating with a Moto Z2 Force, my first Motorola phone in a while. I've been test running this for this month, and I've been really impressed. Motorola is making some nice hardware, and we talked about the Moto X4 I think last week on All About Android with its weird camera design in the back, the dual camera lens that looks. Almost like a manual camera focus knob, but this might be the middle of the road option, and I like that they're rolling Android One out in the U.S. It's really interesting.
Yeah, we'll see how it does for Project Fi users. But of course, if T-Mobile and Sprint merge, as has been rumored for a long time, then Project Fi becomes a little bit less compelling. That's a ways down the way, and that merger will never happen, right? That'll get squashed in regulatory analysis. That'll totally never happen in today's day and age. crazier things will happen. Let's see here. What can we talk about? There's other Google news, right? Google, apparently, so we had the EU decision that basically said that Google had to pay 2.4 billion euros in a fine to the EU in its antitrust case related to Google's shopping search results and it placing favorable, you know, having favorable placement for its own products in comparison to, you know, competing companies that were in the listings. So that was, along with that fine came some requirements for Google to really kind of change things so that they could address some of these issues. Google is appealing this, but in the meantime, it still has to kind of make the effort to stand up and make some changes according to the EU. So apparently Google is proposing to auction off some of that space to its rivals. Curious to know what you guys think about this. To list products for sale. So if I'm understanding this correctly, instead of Google showing its own products, it's saying, how about we auction this off to you guys? You pay us lots of money so that we don't put our own products there. Is that what this is?
This falls into the category of what I would like to call a nice try. So, you know, why not? Like, they're appealing it anyway.
Yeah,
why not
true.
Kind of lob this out there? There's no... And in fact, if you look at that article that's in the lineup, there is no hope that anyone is going to think that this is a solution. And in fact, everyone who's heard about it, including all the people who brought the action in the first place, this is not going to work because their fear is Google will just... So Google said, oh, we'll put a cap on it.
Right.
So then, you know, it can't go up. We won't be able to bid any more than the cap. Well... they have to do is set the cap ridiculously high and then no one will be able to beat it. And even if they do beat it, Google makes way more money.
Right.
So it doesn't actually have the smell of what you would call a solution to the criticisms that, like, I have my, I'm skeptical of the criticisms that the EU is acting on. I don't think that most of what Google does in terms of showing its own results meets any real standard of sort of antitrust or anti-competitiveness. There are things that it does that I think do, but just when I search for umbrellas and, you know, Google shows me its umbrella results or travel, those are things that help the user. The EU is arguing they're fundamentally anti-competitive. I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, but I don't think they're going to get anywhere with this offer for sure.
I want to give him points for creativity, that's for sure, and innovation. that's good. I would expect nothing less from Google to try to figure out a way for them to profit from the slap on the wrist that they got from the EU. So
it's like you get charged with an offense and it has like a 6-month jail term, and you're like, well, why don't we raffle off specific jail terms for me, and then I'll, you know, we'll see who bids the most, and then that's what I'll go to jail for.
Hey, it never hurts to try, right? You don't get anything if you don't ask.
You don't find out if you don't ask. Can't hurt, you know, it can't hurt to ask.
Yeah, what the heck?
Yeah.
And it shows that they're doing something. They're just not doing something that anyone really, really thinks is an actual solution. But hey, there you go. Let's see here. What else can we talk about? We talked about this a little bit last night and the day before. Sorry, Ron. But I think it's kind of cool, this idea of, so Google has a payment app rolling out in India, and I'm wondering if we're going to see it in other places, or at least this kind of technology coming to other places as well. Maybe India is kind of like a test point for this. But the app is called Tez. I want to call it Tez, but someone... I'm trusting someone last night that said it's actually Tez. So there you go. And it's basically, it's a way to use the app to link up to financial accounts and, you know, trade cash, essentially. India has, you know, certain, it's a very fragmented money market. And so they're very focused on cash. And so the government is doing a lot of things to try and help people kind of break that and kind of, you know, dealing with the fragmentation. So Google created this app to kind of work with that. And what's I find interesting is that for person to person cash transfers, it doesn't use NFC necessarily to connect between them. It uses something. God, did I put that in here? It's basically, it's like an audio QR code. And so it puts out an inaudible beep that we can't hear to our ears anyways. It's outside of the human hearing range, but that the devices can hear, and that makes the connection. And then you transfer money. It's like the future, man. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, it does sound cool. I don't know enough about audio technology to know whether this is going to be secure. Like, if it's just sound, can't something make the same sound and effectively achieve the same transaction? I don't know if that's the case or if that's possible.
On the other side, can I intercept your sound and then use it at other places? Right.
Right.
Because it has to have the payment, all the information encoded in the signal, right?
Yeah.
Or at some point after the signal, that information is exchanged.
Right.
Unless what it's doing is I can't imagine it's transferring any sensitive data in the audio QR. It's got to be transferring a marker that is saying, you know, beep, bop, boop. And then the other side says,
so
beep, bop, boop.
And right?
it's a handshake. And then at the up on the server side, it figures out, okay, you're who you are, and I'm going to take your money from your account. And none of it is happening on the application level. That's really, that's how it's got to be working. Because
all you have to do is duplicate the handshake, right? Then all you have to do is make the beep, boop, whatever. It would be fun if it made the same sounds as like early dial-up modems.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
Yeah, we really need to go back to that. Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense because, as this article points out, a lot of people, particularly in developing countries, don't have NFC on their phones because they're probably got a flip phone, you know, that was handed down to them. And so it makes sense to use some other type of technology. Just not sure whether the sound is the way to go. And I don't know enough about it to criticize it.
Wait a minute, I'm getting an AQR. Code right now.
ATDT. ATDT.
Cool. I just gave you $50, Matthew. Sorry.
And if they do this, are dogs in the neighborhood?
Sorry, I can't hear you over the internet.
Are all the dogs in the neighborhood going to get upset if people start transferring?
Yeah, because we're taking their money.
We've tried to shoot holes in this, but I'm gonna play devil's advocate, and there are very smart people at Google who have figured this out.
I'm gonna assume that any
scenario we even invent, they have an answer for. Or they wouldn't roll this out. I can't imagine Google would be so brazen with a financial app like this. So
yeah,
it does feel like us in 5 minutes could not come up with something that Google engineers have not thought of.
Wait a minute. We couldn't figure this out in 5 minutes? We are slipping. Let's see here. What else do we have here?
The Chrome story about blocking autoplay videos I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I was circling on that too, actually. Apparently Chrome browser. So Google's doing a lot of things right now when it comes to making adjustments to Chrome to kind of make the browsing experience better. A lot of this stuff seems to relate to ads, right? They have their own ad blocking mechanism or setup that's apparently going to appear inside Chrome. They also have their, what is it, a Google contributor that I think you've been doing, right, Ron?
Yep.
For a while. So this kind of ties into that, I think. Chrome browser is going to soon be able to mute the audio of any autoplay video content that appears on a page unless the user has specifically said it's okay to play that. So with Chrome 63, that's kind of where the changes will begin. Users are going to be able to have the control over muting specific sites. But then at Chrome 64, it's going to broaden out so that you will only ever hear audio on any of the sites if you have explicitly told Chrome in some way that it's okay. And I think part of how you do that, or part of how it knows whether it's okay to do it, is like your interaction with the site. If you like open up a tab to a site and you don't do anything on the page, that's one indicator, and it says, okay, well, you haven't done anything on the page, so why would I, you know, I, Chrome, expect that you would want to hear this audio? But if you click on the page in some way or scroll around, I'm not really quite sure to what degree of level that will take place.
Or if you visit it frequently, maybe.
Yeah, maybe something along those lines, yeah.
You know, this is one of those things, and Contributor and a bunch of the Google sort of Chrome built-in ad blocking thing I have problems with as well, because from a kind of media industry point of view, this is a classic example of something that users will love and media companies will hate, because a lot of them rely on autoplay video. Is it bad? Yes. It's a horrible, horrible user experience. And I know that because I go to a lot of sites that use it. I worked for one that used it and I hated it every single time. So Google wins a lot of points by doing this because it makes for a better experience for users. The problem is a lot of publishers, for better or worse, use a lot of these videos and other garbage forms of advertising to generate revenue because they literally can't think of anything else to do, or because they have no other option or whatever. So the problem with these types of measures, and surely the ad blocking one, is an obvious one, is they increase the control that Google has over the revenue generating abilities of media companies. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, lots of media companies do terrible things to make money, and that's bad. But Google and Facebook together already control, you know, the vast majority of online advertising. I think last year all of the growth in digital advertising went to Google and Facebook. If you took those two out, the digital advertising market actually shrank. So it's centralizing that control in even more ways. And then I'm sure Google has lots of other ways for you to monetize, including Contributor and subscriptions that Google then handles. So it's, do you know what I'm saying? It's a little Absolutely. Bit of a, yeah, as a user, it's a fantastic thing. And I think it's great. In terms of their relationship to the kind of media ecosystem, it's troubling.
Well, and I mean, as far as Google is concerned, it's a great solution because it puts them in even more control over the experience. You know, there are a lot of people that use third-party ad blockers. Google's not necessarily saying don't use ad blockers. They're just saying use our ad blocker, and you know, then we've got control over the experience. You know, not to mention this whole approach to ad blocking in Chrome, you know, kind of hinges on Google making a determination based on standards of quality that have been set prior, but makes the determination of what is a good ad and what is not a good ad. And I don't know, I'm just guessing here, but I'm guessing that Google's ads are going to be good ads because they're following those rules. And anyone that doesn't have good ads are Google's competitors that they're not letting you see their ads because, and you know, mind you, as a user, again, that's great. I don't want bad ads in my experience, but that really benefits Google. And is that, I don't know, is that too much? I mean, does that cross the line?
And this goes back to all those questions about Google's power.
Right.
And what that power, like if Google was, you know, a smaller company, did fewer things, wasn't as sort of dominant in advertising, all of these things would be fantastic. And these, it falls into the kind of category of things where if Google did it 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when it was smaller, we would all be cheering, right? Offering free email or, you know, maps and satellite views of the earth. We were like, wow, these are fantastic and Google is amazing. But the more power you get and the sort of more you become not just a dominant player, but the dominant player, all those things that you do that would once have seemed innocent and helpful, you know, start to look like you're kind of feathering your own nest in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Somewhat related to this, only because it's kind of the ad network side of Google, and this also, you know, bubbled up with Facebook. I think initially, actually, it hit late last week in relation to Facebook, but then eventually BuzzFeed dug into it with Google and saw the same thing, is this idea of ad targeting based on, well, racist phrases is were the examples that were shown. BuzzFeed found that Google was allowing ad targeting for, you know, pretty horrible phrases and everything, that you could actually, as an ad buyer, target your product or your message or whatever, your advertisement, against these phrases if people are searching for them or whatever. Facebook also kind of came under the microscope for this as well. Their system was also allowing a lot of these terms to be marketed against, and in their you know, to their benefit, they did address these once they were notified about this by BuzzFeed, and I think it was ProPublica that found initially what Facebook was doing. But you know, part of me just wasn't.
I think Twitter does this as well, right?
That's right. They're actually
could do the same thing on Twitter.
Yep, there was news that Twitter was doing this as well, which I think, you know, further kind of proves my hesitation around this, which is like, how, I mean, is this just part of the ad network world?
So like, this is, why? it's a great example of how, of the flaws, I guess, in or the risks with a totally distributed model. So all of these companies, and I think Google was among the first, Facebook later, Twitter later, tried to kind of make their ad buying as user friendly as possible and as sort of accessible as possible, so that the amount of input you had to have from human beings at that company was approaching zero, if not zero. So self-serve, click here, type in your terms, weak algorithm gives you the prices, boom, 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 you're done. And in fact, Sheryl Sandberg wrote something, I don't know if it's in the lineup, but she responded to these stories and said, you know, we screwed up and this is terrible and we feel horrible and we will take action to stop it. But her point was, what made this possible was all the things they tried to do to make it easier for small business owners to get ads and run ads about their businesses, no matter how unusual those businesses are. So, you know, reused Frisbee rentals or whatever, there's probably not going to be a category in a system run by a normal advertising company. So you can literally enter anything you want. So what happened in these cases, as far as I understand it, is people just typed in racist terms where it said, you know, what business are you in? So that's a kind of, yes, it's a flaw, obviously. And for the system to not say, whoa, dude, that's totally racist, we can't sell ads against that, they didn't do that. So the controls weren't there in any of these companies to stop people from typing in those terms. Whether any ads were actually sold or run against those terms, who knows? But I think, to me, it's just an example of how kind of automated these systems are and how much they rely on you, the business person or whoever, to type in things that make sense related to your business.
It reminded me of Microsoft's Tay, where Tay came out and like almost immediately, you know, everybody started targeting Tay with certain phrases and words and basically made Tay a racist AI chatbot. And
like 2 hours,
you know, very short amount of time. It was mind boggling how fast it happened. But in retrospect, looking at that and going, man, I mean, like it's not impossible to protect against that. So why didn't you think about that? That's kind of how I feel about this. Like, I get the idea of a self-service model, but it's also very easy to be like, these two words when put together, there's like no way why anyone should be able to buy ads against that term.
And not to play devil's advocate to defend them, but I think it's more sad of the state of affairs of the world today that this has relevance because of everything around and outside the tool. Yeah. But if you look at the searches that they, you know, like the obvious expletives and horrible racial slurs and things like that, I'm sure already blocked. And I can't, and I'm not surprised that someone at Google or Facebook did not sit back and say, well, what if somebody searches for, you know, insert ethno group.
Yeah, horrible phrase here. Yeah,
insert not even horrible phrase. White people ruin everything. That was one of them, right? Right. Or, you know, like things like that. Those are strings of words that I can't say I would have thought of if I was building
that
tool.
That's true.
You know, and they're the we've gotten to a point of, unfortunately, people who potentially want to purvey hate in a way that they're getting creative to work around the tools, and that's game theory. That's just natural. Yeah. That's people are going to figure out ways to get across what they want to have to do. So I'm glad that ProPublica and BuzzFeed and all the other posts are being watchdogs, because that's what we need the media to do and point this out, and the companies are responding in kind. But I mean, when I saw this, it was like, ooh, that's rough. But then as I dug deep into it, I'm like, I see how that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It is. It does feel more to me like a bug, you know, in a self-serve ad system than – holy cow, Facebook is internally racist,
right?
You know,
for sure.
Yeah. Well, are other things Facebook does that are way worse. Let's put it that way. Yeah. So deleting videos about the Rohingya being massacred, that's an actual bad thing that raises questions about what Facebook is doing. The fact that you can auto-generate an ad related to some childish term that you just came up with doesn't trouble me that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, saying Twitter also has this problem. We all know about the rampant problem with Twitter, with abuse and with trolls and things like that. And the recent, you know, taking, you know, 2 hour turnaround to delete a terrorist related themed tweet or something like that. Like they've got to get better about this stuff, you know. And the desire to make it automated makes sense from a scaling issue, but we're dealing with subjects and we're dealing with things that require a human touch. And so they've got to get better.
That's a great point. I mean, mm-hmm. Facebook and Google and lots of other companies have, you know, Facebook built this entire network based on the idea that human beings had to be tangentially involved. Human beings were the input of content, but in terms of running it, because at one point, I can't remember if Mark Zuckerberg actually said this or if people figured he said this, but human beings don't scale. So if you want to get to global size, you can't have human beings doing everything. It costs too much money. So, and this came up when Facebook started having problems with racist content, fake news, whatever. They've had to hire thousands, like 5,000 or something, moderators, because some things, and this is probably one of them, human beings are way better at recognizing those things than computers are. And maybe that won't always be the case, but it certainly seems to be the case right now.
Yeah.
It's a really good point. Human beings recognized that Tay was racist, you know, literally 5 minutes after the thing started. And sure, that was a great symbol of Tay realizing that, hey, human beings are racist, which is true. Yeah. But it was also a sign that Microsoft could probably have thought it through a little bit more. I mean, you know, we've had chatbots since like the 70s.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, Matthew, reused Frisbee business, I think it's going to be a hot trend in 2019. A couple of years from now, it's trending up
already,
right now.
I've got the domain already.
any last thing before we thank a sponsor and then get to our tips and tricks and all that? Anything burning stories that you had to talk about before the end of this show?
I think we've covered all mine. The only thing I would mention is the the sort of I don't think we talked about the open markets group that's going after Google, specifically based around antitrust. There's a whole, you know, internal politics around them branching off from this other foundation and Google asking for them to be tossed out or not, depending on how you kind of read between the lines. But there is clearly a very significant a number of, legal scholars and people with experience in government who are going after Google specifically to redefine the way antitrust is thought of in the U.S. Whether they're going to be successful or not, who knows? But I think for Google, that's a significant problem, and because it dovetails perfectly with what the EU has been trying to do. And until now, it's always been, well, that's just a bunch of Germans and French people and maybe some Spaniards and the Italians, and who cares, because it's just the EU, and yes, they're all hot about, you know, this stuff, but it's not that big a deal because it doesn't affect kind of our main market. Well, this is going to the heart of that. If open markets and that group can get a significant amount of kind of interest going in Congress, that's going to be a significant problem for Google for sure. Because it defines, not to get into too much detail, but it defines antitrust in a way in the past for probably the last 30 years, U.S. antitrust has looked at, is the consumer harmed? That's the number one thing. So if all your stuff is free and everything, you know, works great and users are happy, no antitrust problem. Mm-hmm. So what open markets wants to do is redefine that to look at actual competition, and that could be a significant problem.
Yeah, like I was saying earlier, inflection point for technology, because it's not just Google either. Like, I have a feeling like the tide is turning, so to speak, with big technology companies right now. And, you know, we've been really, you know, we've been amazed at just how much you can do with the power and the scale of these technology companies working for you. And now, I think in light of a lot of things that happened last year, people have realized just what that amount of power can scale up to, like what the impact of that can be and continues to be more and more and more. Yep. And that some of these rules, maybe they do need to change, because we're in a different world now when it comes to technology and the information age than we were 20 years ago.
Yeah. All of those antitrust principles were based around physical things.
Yeah.
Physical objects, you know, trains, oil, whatever. Like, they weren't designed to understand the power of network effects. And so, sure, anybody can use another social network. They don't have to go use Facebook, but are they going to? No. Like, lots of people didn't even stop using Twitter when it was a trash fire. So because those network effects are what keep you in those networks. And so then that gives those companies way more power. But it doesn't always kind of, the analogy is not perfect between that and owning a bunch of railway, you know, cars that then distribute oil. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's mm-hmm. the part people are struggling with.
Yeah. Agreed. Very fascinating time for technology right now, and definitely for Google, as we kind of see the effects of what the EU is doing and how that translates into the US and other markets. Big change ahead. Real quick, before we do get to the break, I failed to mention this, and it's kind of, you know, it's today's news, so we should mention it here real quick. Nest, after so long of, you know, people saying, man, you know, Google bought Nest and then they did nothing. They really, you know, lack any sort of new production. Today they announced a whole bunch of new stuff. The Nest Secure Alarm System is basically like a full security system for your home. It includes like a siren, the Nest Guard, like that sounds a super loud 85 decibel alarm, Nest Detect for, you know, attaching to your windows and your doors, you know, when they open and close, Nest Tag for putting onto things like your keys or whatever, so you don't lose them. Sounds familiar. And then, you know, a bunch of other things, including a baking assistant, Google's assistant, into things like the Nest Cam, IQ, camera. And then also they announced the Nest Cam IQ outdoor camera. All this stuff is really expensive. I think the full security system is, what is that, around $500 or something?
Well, the thing about this, what struck me from this is that it's almost been like Nest has been this sleeping dog that's been lying in the world of IoT, right? In that they, you know, the thermostat, you know, blew everyone's mind, and then the smoke alarm had some problems,
yeah.
And then they got had a lot of internal reorg and structuring, yep. And you know, Tony Fadell left, and all the, you know, like all these various stuff that was going on, and then it seems like this is, you know, what they've done is they took a step back and looked at the IoT market and was like, oh, small tags to track your items, that's doing well, doing one of those. Mm-hmm. Oh, outdoor cameras or interfaces for outside your home, we're going to do one of those. And now they're marching back, yeah. To kind of target every successful product that is in the IoT play space and add both Nest and the power of Google Assistant behind it to justify those high costs, you know, the more expensive products. And my guess is they're probably going to do well because everyone loves the Nest thermostat.
Yeah.
And I think they have a real chance. I mean, like you said, this is a kind of wide open market in a way. It's like the Wild West, and there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of integration problems. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't work that well. If they can kind of nail the integration, getting all of these things to work properly, having them all connect through the Google Assistant and connect to your Google Home or whatever, that's going to be a significant, you know, that's going to be a big selling point for people, I think.
Mm-hmm. They also have a doorbell camera, by the way, the Hello doorbell camera. I mean, they're touching on all these things.
Very familiar, right? I mean, a lot of the products that we talk about here on Twit, right? And these are all, and if somebody has a Nest thermostat, you know, they're like, well, I can control this all from the Google Home app or from the Nest app. You know, why would I want multiple people want to buy into a system, right?
How long until Nest has their own multicolor light bulbs? They're going to get into the Hue game.
Oh, yeah.
I would be surprised. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Totally. Although I do know, speaking of Google and power, I know a friend, as soon as I mention this or send a link, they're going to be like, sure, I want Google to have a camera inside my house and outside my house. Sure, I want Google to control my front doorbell. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Uh-huh.
Nope.
Eyes and ears in every corner of the home. Yeah. That's kind of the deeper meaning, apparently.
To help you.
Yes, to make your life more convenient, and to make our life better because we profit from it. real quick, before we get into tips and tricks, I want to thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Felix Gray. We stare at our screens all the time. Think of how often you look at your screen. You might be looking at a screen now. You probably are if you're watching this show anyways. Or you might be listening to this podcast to get away from one. And if so, I totally understand. Been there. We've all, you know, had the eye rub moment. I feel like I have it all the time. Your eyes feel dry. They feel fatigued. You have a headache. Your vision goes blurry. You can give your eyes a break with a pair of computer glasses from Felix Gray. And it's just an awesome way to kind of help your eyes not feel so tired at the end of the day if you're staring at screens all the time. Felix Gray's lenses are specially designed to filter blue light and eliminate glare, which many of us know are the two culprits behind digital eye strain. Too much blue light from your computer and phone screen can lead to eye strain and make it difficult to focus. Felix Gray glasses have blue light filtering material embedded into the lens so they remain effective without that ugly yellow tint that you're used to seeing or color distortion that you get with other computer glasses. You want to make sure to visit felixgrayglasses.com/twig. And you can find more information on the dangers of blue light. But we hear about this all the time. Reducing the amount of blue light it's good for you in so many ways. I didn't know what glasses I was going to end up with, so I chose at random. This is one pair. They have tons of different styles. If you go to the site, you can pick your way through them and find a style that works for you. Here's a little tortoise style. I wore tortoise glasses. Never have since.
You look great in a pair of glasses, Jason. I'll give you credit, man. Very debonair.
Thank you very much, Ron.
You look much smarter now.
Oh,
you look much smarter.
What? I mean, you kind of got a Clark Kent thing going on there.
What
you
if I wear two? Even smarter? See, it doesn't work like that. Felix Gray, thank you, by the way. Felix Gray eyewear is beautifully crafted from premium handmade Italian acetate. Their glasses look great, so you can feel confident in any work environment. Non-prescription and reading lenses are also available, and prescription glasses are coming soon. So if that's something you're holding out for, you don't have to wait very much longer. Reading prescription ranges from plus 1.0 to plus 2.5, or you can add a 0.25 magnification if you're fixated to your screen, like if you're a programmer, financial analyst, you know if that applies to you. All orders include free shipping and free returns, so there's no risk in trying them out. And, you know, buying glasses, it's a very personal thing, right? Like only certain glasses styles you might feel comfortable with, and you want to own these when you wear them. So, you know, you can try them out. And if it doesn't work, ship it back. You get free returns and try on some more. So check them out for yourself. Give your eyes the break that they deserve. Go to felixgrayglasses.com/twig, T-W-I-G, and go there today and you can try a pair of Felix Gray computer glasses and discover a smarter way to work. If you're staring at the screen all day, you might as well protect your eyes in the process. That's felixgrayglasses.com/twig, and we thank Felix Gray for their support of This Week in Google. Okay. This is the tools, tips, tricks, whatever you got part of the show. Ron, we'll start with you because I do see one in here for you. I'm trying to remember if I've seen this before.
I don't know if you have. This one's skirting the edge of what's okay to talk about, but I figured go with it. Fall TV season is upon us. It's my most favorite time of the year. I got my Entertainment Weekly fall TV preview. The Emmys were just on this past weekend. New TV shows are coming at us. And if you're like me, you like to watch TV, and I live and die by Plex. Plex is my kind of media center app.
Me too.
It's fantastic. But Plex doesn't do it. Plex is great for putting stuff into it, but it's not so good about telling you what's coming. And so there's an app called Sonar, which is a little desktop app that is able to subscribe to series that you watch and enjoy, and it accesses all the databases that are out there on the internet and makes a really cool integrated kind of interface that allows you to see when the air dates for shows are. And there's also a bunch of really cool little notifications, hooks, and little recipes you can put together to give me a notification when this new show is on. It also will go get the show if you subscribe to those types of methods to do that, and that's what I'm not going to talk about.
We're not allowed to talk about that.
Not going to talk about that, but it's there if you're into that sort of thing. But it's really, really handy for just like, you know, you ever watch a show and then it disappears? Like, when is that coming back? And then you realize, oh, the baseball playoffs are going on. It's going to be back in November. Sonar is a great way to keep track of the shows you watch on typical cable and broadcast TV. Not so much for streaming side of things, but it's a tool that I started using last year and I can't live without it. I got it all dusted off and ready to go for this upcoming fall season. So Sonar, it's at sonar.tv. It's a downloadable desktop package you can install for Mac, Windows, or Linux, and it's pretty nifty. And I will leave the rest of it to you to discover on your own.
You can do good. You can do not so good. Sonar with two R's, by the way. So S-O-N-A-R-R.
Yep. Yeah.
R. Yeah. Just talking like a pirate day the other day. So it's too bad this wasn't then. Okay, sonar.tv. Matthew, do you have a thing, tip, trick, anything? What you got?
Actually, well, I didn't really have anything, but it's interesting that Ron mentioned Sonar. I experimented with Sonar not that long ago. I also have I'm a big Plex fan, and I have a Linux box that I use as sort of a media server, Plex server, photo, you know, hosting, all that stuff. And I so Sonar, if you like TV and movies and music, there's a they're not related, like they come from different people, but a lot of people use them together. There's Sonar for TV, Couch Potato, it's called, for movies, and headphones for music. And I got all of these working, and then something happened with the box, and they stopped doing the things they're supposed to do. Because it's Linux, obviously, I probably have to recompile something from the kernel or whatever. But anyway, at one point it was working, and they do exactly what Ron was talking about with Sonar. They keep track of the things that you like, and they tell you when there's new things, and then you use a variety of methods to get those things. but it's great if you have a media server and that's the kind of thing you want to do. I won't go into the details.
That's awesome. See, you did have a tip.
Yeah, there it is.
It took Ron's tip to bring it to the surface. Yeah. That's awesome. That's expanded information that totally adds on. It's like a full media solution that you have now. Mine has nothing to do with that, though. So when you're done setting up your media solution, and then when you get Android 8.0 Oreo, which could take a really long time to come to your device, but if and when that happens, did you know that there is system-wide theming? So if you've got Android 8.0 and you want to theme everything in your system, almost everything in your system, prior to Oreo, you had to root. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people would root access to their device so that they could get in there, they could mess with the files, alter the files in a way that would totally theme the look and feel of their device. And apparently in Android 8, there is a theming engine. The folks at Substratum that had systems prior to Android 8.0 that did this launched their app and their desktop app set up to do this. It taps into Android's Overlay Manager Service, OMS. Talked about this on All About Android a couple of months ago, but the reason I'm talking about it now is because it's all out now and you can do this. The app that you're looking for is called Andromeda, not to be confused with the once fabled Andromeda Chrome OS Android combination that never happened. And you can buy it. You see there, it's $1.99 to buy the app to install it. But once you have that installed, and once you have their desktop client installed, that desktop client, you plug your phone into your computer, and that desktop client gets the permissions to make the changes on your unrooted Oreo device. So you do not need root. Yet you can use this to completely theme your device. I haven't tried it myself yet. I just realized that it's all good to go and it's now public. So I definitely want to play around with it. But you can theme the Android system, the system UI, settings menu, navigation buttons. You can get in there and play around with it. It'll survive a reboot. Sometimes on these things, you do it and then you reboot and it wipes it back to normal. So when you reboot, your theme is going to stick around. The permissions will not. So you'll still have to plug it into the desktop app to make the changes, even revert it back to the way it was initially. But you can get in there and you can theme to your heart's content and you don't even need root to do it anymore. Less and less reason to root your device. And that's thanks to the folks at Substratum that put this all together for you. So pretty cool. But, who has Oreo? Not many people. So you might be waiting a while. Hope you don't, though. And once it happens, you have something fun to do. All right. I think we did it. We did it. We made it to the end, and that was a lot of fun. We had a lot of Google stuff to talk about, and I'm really happy that I got to do it with both of you guys. Thank you, Matthew Ingram. It is always a pleasure and an honor to do a podcast with you, sir. Tell people what you're working on. Where do you want people to kind of follow all the things you're doing these days?
Actually, probably Twitter is the best, and also MatthewIngram.com/work. Matthew only has one T. I'm hoping kind of in between things at the moment. I left Fortune back in June, so I'm hoping to have something to announce soon. But right, yeah, on. So keep in touch.
Absolutely. Well, I can't wait to see where you end up, where you land. Someone's going to be lucky to find you on the job market and snap you up, I'm sure. Absolutely, man. It's always so much fun to get the chance to talk to you. So thank you for joining us. And what about you, Ron? Has anything changed since yesterday?
Nothing changed since yesterday, but maybe somebody didn't watch yesterday. So,
all right, so there's that.
You definitely want to make sure to watch the aforementioned All About Android here on the Twit Network every Tuesday around 5:30 p.m. Pacific time, 8:30 p.m. Eastern time, where Jason, myself, and Florence Ion and special guests are always talking about the greatest hits of Android, what's going on in the world of Android, a deep dive, if you would. And then if you want to follow what's going on with me, much like Matthew, you can follow me on Twitter at RonXO, also on Instagram where I post nonsense and fun things I see in the world. But then also I've got some other podcasts. You can go to ifanboy.com where you can find out not anything about Apple, but about comic books, where we're talking about comic books, movies, TV shows, fun things like that. And then if you're into the TV show Twin Peaks, you might want to check out damnfinepodcast.com, where myself and Tom Merritt and special guests over the past year rewatched all of Twin Peaks, including the new TV show. And if you're into the TV show, please check it out because it's a fun kind of companion to watching Twin Peaks. So there you go. And Jason, thanks for having me. It's always a blast to do Twig.
Yeah, it is. And it was a great week of Ron. Yes. Really appreciate it, man. Lots of fun. But I get to podcast with you next Tuesday. And now I'm realizing, Matthew, I need to invite you on All About Android, and I will follow up with an email. Don't feel like you have to come on, but if you would like to, we would love to have you.
Yeah, so absolutely.
I'll be in touch. We have a lot of fun on All About Android. Cool. So I will be in touch on that. But as far as I'm concerned, well, All About Android, obviously, tech news today, filling in for Leo. Actually, this weekend, I'm doing the new screensavers. So I'm going to be here having fun with that. I hope we're going to show a VR thing. I have to check. There's some really cool stuff in the pipeline that I've been involved with new screensavers. I hope we get to see the light of day this weekend. So definitely check that out. As far as This Week in Google is concerned, we record live every Wednesday, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, 20 o'clock UTC. And you can find that live if you happen to, you know, have the time. twit.tv/live is the link. Or you can come into the studio. We have some folks here watching today. And it's always great to have people here in the studio kind of applying a little bit of that live audience pressure. But they've been all smiles the whole time, so it hasn't been pressure at all. And you, of course, go to the twit.tv/TWIG webpage. That's where you're going to find all the episodes that we ever do, everything that you need to know to subscribe to the show. Please subscribe. That way you won't miss any episodes of This Week in Google in your queue. And big thanks to Carson as well for putting the show together today and helping out on the production. My name is Jason Howell. You guys are awesome. Appreciate being here with you. I will see you next week on another episode of This Week in Google. Bye, everybody.